Welcome to part three of the Electrical Engineering Ethics Cases from PDH Online audio version. I feel a compulsion to explain to you my reasoning. I noticed that we've been talking about safety, and a person might quite reasonably say, "Hey, we're here for ethics. Why are you talking about safety?" Well, as I read the NSPE Code of Ethics, holding the public good above all else sounds like safety. If you let somebody put in an excavation without proper shoring, you are in violation of your code of ethics and personally responsible for somebody getting hurt in there. Now, I'm thinking civil, but the case we just heard about where the construction manager says everybody on the site is responsible for following the safety rules suggests that in this particular case, and based upon the form you sign, you are taking personal responsibility for shoring in excavations if you're electrical. And to me, that's ethics. So, I mean, that's how we got from here to there. And again, choosing aluminum wire, is that ethics? Well, yeah, it's spending the public money. Isn't that what ethics is all about? But again, this is my reasoning, what I'm sharing with you, and you get to reach your own conclusion and live your own life according to your best standards. Let's do case 10, use of diversity factor in sizing distribution equipment and feeders. Now, before I get into this, let me explain why this is an ethics case too. The core of electrical engineering, electrical design, is the National Electric Code. I mean, if you can find anybody to argue that point, I'd love to meet that person and spend a half hour with him. Because, I mean, what I do is the electric code. I do a little better than the electric code, and I do things that work. I mean, that's a priority. But the electric code is the structure for everything. Diversity is not in the electric code, and that's what we're going to talk about in a minute. But I use diversity every day. Okay, let's see. When I started electrical design in the middle of the last century, I kind of enjoy saying that, I'm sorry, I hope it doesn't offend you. My first boss told me it's extremely rare for industrial machinery to draw actually the rated full load current, even momentarily. Similar machines do not draw peak power at the same moment. At any given time, there are machines, even entire departments, that are not in service. We provide wiring to each machine sized on its rated full load current, but we usually provide a main panel or switchboard capable of providing less than 50% of the simple total of full load currents. You will note that the plant utility meter never records more than 10% of the plant sum of currents. This is called diversity. It requires verification by periodically checking feeder and panel loading. That's why we have ammeters on the main feeders, end quote. Now, I promise to add a little on to this. As I've gotten older, I've discovered that 100% doesn't mean 100% either. Equipment will handle more than 100% momentarily, and this is not an aberration. This is not abuse. If you look at the response curve of a thermomagnetic protective device, it'll run 150% for 10 minutes. See, 100% is not the absolute limit. And when you get to 100%, you've got to stop. You've got to use some judgment when you exceed 100%, but 100% is not a hard limit. Now, that's from protective overcurrent devices. Is it really okay to overload the wire for 10 minutes? Yeah. I mean, if you look into the physics of what's going on, it has to generate the heat and dissipate it before the temperature rises enough to melt the insulation. It takes a lot of temperature rise to melt the insulation. 10 minutes of 150% doesn't melt anybody's insulation. Matter of fact, the utility guys who live in a slightly different world than we do have permissible overload ratings on their transmission lines, and they know that they can run a transmission line at an excessive load for a period of time with no consequences. Now I pause, and the consequences are the wire gets soft and stretches and hits the trees if you didn't trim the trees. But again, that's not what we're talking about. That's an aside upon an aside. Wires will take overloads. transformers will take overloads. Now, once again, we never ever talk about this in industrial and commercial, but on the utility side, they talk about this. They say, hey, you want to replace that transformer? It's overloaded. And the answer, nah, let's let it burn out. We'll replace it then. It's cheaper than sending the guy out there now, and we got to replace it anyhow. What are you going to do with a 15-year-old transformer? Let's just burn it out and put up a new one. And what they're saying is there are well-defined permissible overloads and consequences. You can run 150% overload and you reduce the life by 1 year or 5 years. But they've got tables that tell them this. They know exactly what they're doing when they make a decision like this. Well, what does that mean to us? That means when we size everything for 100%, we're being extremely conservative. We know it will take momentary overloads. What is a real overload? A real overload is a 15-minute continuous overload. Why do I say this? Once again, go back to the utility case. Utilities vary, but a recognized standard is a 15-minute overload is a demand. That's what you have to size your equipment for, the 15-minute overload. And the customer has to pay for the 15-minute overload. So, once again, where did all this come from? Equipment does not run at peak load. And the reason it doesn't run at peak load is the mechanical engineer always buys an oversized motor. Doesn't want the motor to fail. So if he calculates it requires 95 horsepower, he buys 125. Is that a mistake? No, that's the way we do engineering. If he puts 125 horsepower motor on it, is it going to run at 125? Is it going to run at 95? Is it going to run at 80? Probably going to run at 80 or 70. Matter of fact, in schools, I got involved in an energy conservation thing recently. School receptacle transformers typically run below 20% of load. Now, why is this interesting? Because we buy them based on their efficiency at 70 or 80% load, and we actually run them at 20% load. If we were in any way rational, we'd buy them for efficiency at 20% load where we're actually using them. Okay, back to the story at hand. Diversity means recognizing that 100% is not meaningful, that we downsize the feeders once we get an aggregate. The aggregate lets the peaks fall at different times and they do not fall concurrently. Just based on everything in statistics, random peaks do not fall concurrently. Do they all fall at the start of the shift? Yes, they do all fall at the start of the shift. But we've got a 15-minute overload there that we can tolerate 150% overload. So even recognizing that we get into overload, overload is okay. Now, this is not what the National Electric Code says, and that's the whole point of calling it an ethical discussion. Diversity is not mentioned in the enforceable portions of the 2008 National Electric Code. It's mentioned several times in non-enforceable footnotes and in one table heading. It's used 8 times in the National Electric Code handbook, which again is non-enforceable. The question, is diversity a valid concept if not defined and regulated by the National Electric Code? Well, what can you do about this? You can seek an interpretation from the NFPA. They have a form for doing that, for seeking an interpretation or seeking a change. Second, you can be very, very careful using demand factor, which is defined and regulated by the National Electric Code. C, you can continue using diversity as before. Now, there's a very fine nuance between B using demand factor and C using diversity. Demand factor means that your primary concern is following the tables that give you 80%, 60%, 50% discounts for more dryers than one, more electric stoves than one. There's some for restaurant occupancies. C is use diversity based upon everything you know about engineering and the last job. I mean, God help us, we do design the current project based on the last job. If the inspector liked it there and the plans examiner liked it, we're going to do something pretty similar unless we have a reason to change it. And that's one of the choices available to us. Something that's not on this list is go out and measure feeder loading and improve the diversity numbers at hand. That would have been a nice one to put down there. That would be a nice one to... Boy, I wish I could write a course on that. I'm babbling. Let's get back to work. Discussion of ethics. Choice A requires motivation on the part of the design engineer with firm expectation of no response or action based on previous experience with NFPA submissions. Choice B is compliant with the NSPE Code of Ethics and well serves the public interest. The care in applying demand factors is that the tables are quite explicit and require effort for initial application and at least final coordination of equipment installed before release of the bid set. Choice B is further complicated by the few available demand tables in the National Electric Code. There's nothing there for tire building machines or CNC grinders or mist collectors. Choice C includes Choice B, the demand tables, and a little more judgment involved. Well, what is the activity selected? I just continue using the diversity. I feel comfortable with that. I don't feel that there is an ethical conflict, even though it's not listed in the National Electric Code. Success of the selection, up to and including the 2008 National Electric Code, this method has been satisfactory. Wording in the 2008 code, that's section 230.23, implies that future service sizing may be required to use the calculated watts per square foot values completely divorced from real-world loads. Now, if you look at the watts per square foot things, they're much more for commercial than they are for industrial. I pray that we can still use some judgment on industrial, but it seems to be saying that we must use their watt per square foot tables for sizing the main distribution panel in an office building or a school or a church, you know, commercial occupancy. What we can learn from this: there's a distance between the published electric code and the practice of electrical design engineering. Good design results from ethical application of both experience and the code. Simply following the code is not adequate. Now, that's my conclusion, and if you disagree with that, I encourage you to pursue your own thoughts, but at least for the 5 minutes you're taking the quiz at the end, recognize that I and the computer agree that design requires ethical application of both experience and the code. This would be a good place to beseech young, strong engineers to keep submitting NEC changes to try to bridge the gulf between the code and the real world. This might also apply to old, strong engineers. And in the written version of the course, there is a reproduction of the form for proposals for the 2011 National Electric Code. And there are a lot of jokes on this. All proposals must be received by November 7, 2008. Whoops! Now, that doesn't mean that it's not worth sending in. That means it will not be incorporated in the 2011. But it's still a good idea to send your ideas to the NFPA. Second, this form says for view only, copyright 2008 National Fire Protection Association for individual use, no other reproduction or transmission of the form is permitted. I think that is a wonderful joke. Their proposal form is copyrighted and you're not allowed to Xerox it. I hope that's a joke. If they're going to try and enforce that, I kind of look forward to going to court and listening to them explain that to the judge. Case 11, opening energized equipment for observation or testing. The situation: an existing substation is needed for a current project. It hasn't been used since it was flooded 10 years ago. It has been energized, providing security lighting without recent inspection. And we don't know what happened 10 years ago, except the water level was above the top of the substation sheet metal. Are we going to follow corporate safety policy and de-energize for inspection, or use arc flash personal protective equipment and inspect it hot? The alternatives available are to de-energize and inspect cold, use personal protective equipment and inspect hot, or we could use no personal protective equipment and inspect hot, or we could hire a contract inspection firm. Well, let's discuss this for a moment. A, de-energize and inspect cold, that's good corporate loyalty, NEC, OSHA, NSPE, I mean, everybody's in favor of de-energizing. Choice B, considerable hazard. This is PPE and energize hot, but protections are in place to limit the consequences to survivable burns. And there's a reference here, a place called benchmarkfr.com, fire retardant, that's what the FR is, /industries.html, where they show pictures of people after they've been wearing personal protective equipment and they got hit by an arc flash. And the burns are survivable. Boy, we feel good about that. But if you look at those burns, those are not burns that you would like to spend 6 months healing. This whole thing on personal protective equipment and survivable burns deserves some close thought on the part of the people involved. Choice C, no personal protective equipment and inspect hot. That appears to be a bad idea. First off, it's intentional violation of the law, and consequences are not limited to survivable burns. Choice D is mostly ethical. Hire a contract inspection firm. It limits liability since it transfers it to the contractor. It's clearly ethical if the owner specifies OSHA compliance and observes the work to verify compliance. Activity selected. We selected both C and D, but didn't observe the contractor. The electrical foreman, electrician, and I honestly thought there was a grounded plate behind the front cover, separating us from energized bus bars. However, there wasn't. The 480-volt copper was 2 inches from us, swinging around the sheet metal cover, which had no hinges, and it was big and heavy. We survived and replacing the cover after taking pictures. There was no arc flash. There was nothing bad happened, but we did it hot. Later on, when he called the contractor, he refused to tell me the day he was going to open the cabinet until it had passed. Interestingly, I was the guy who signed the requisition and had included the requirement for witnessing. But there was no report of contractor personnel hurt or killed. Now, what can we learn from this? Now that I am aware of the normal safety level of our plant electricians, I will avoid being present when inspection work is performed. If I am there and they continue such procedures, I am passively assisting violation of OSHA. I am actively violating NSPE. Next time, I will try harder to be present when the contractor does his work. I have an insatiable curiosity regarding theory and practice. Case 12, grounding 480-volt feeders for new equipment tie-in. The contractor had requested to de-energize a main panel board in order to terminate new incoming feeder conductors for a new circuit breaker. I guess those would be outgoing feeder conductors. The published safe work procedure states they will ground the panel bus conductors. The question, will they really? The reason I ask that question is, I have no idea how to do this. Now, part of that's my lack of experience inside panel boards, but, I mean, I'm just visualizing what I see, and I don't see how you ground it out on a 480-volt panel board. According to the written material, it's a square D I-line interior and a QED switchboard enclosure. Nice stuff. It has excellent finger-safe power buses. I was asking how they were going to ground the bus. Well, the alternatives available are to de-energize, lockout, tagout, but do not ground the buses. B, clamp the supply terminals on the supply side of the panel with your grounds. Yeah, that ought to work. C, rig up something that is grounded on one side and mates with the buses on the other side. Now, if you've seen these buses, they are very well sandwiched between insulators. It's hard to get anything except the exact stabs for a circuit breaker into that hole. But rig up something. Okay, discussion of ethics. Choice A is consistent with 480-volt work for the past 60 years that I'm aware of. It meets general standards of safety, but not the higher standards of the published work procedure. Choice B is difficult. The source terminals are also finger safe. There is no hazard associated with this effort, but it costs time with the crew standing by. Choice C is innovative and requires desk time, if not crew field time. Activity selected, choice A. They went ahead without grounding it out. Choice C was rejected due to time constraints and lack of interest. As motivated by preparation of this course, however, I have investigated Square D offerings for I-line panels. They sell a 1200 amp molded case switch, that's a non-automatic molded case circuit breaker, which is rated for 100,000 amps withstand, that is with 100,000 amp operating breaker upstream. And I include the section in the Square D E catalog where they sell this thing and give the KA withstand ratings. This information will be placed in the presented to the current project construction manager and the plant electrical engineer for possible use in the future. Now, I guess that lethargy will control in this case also, because it's a pain in the butt to have this piece sitting around until you need it and then bring it the day you need it. But it is possible. There is no technology hurdle to grounding out the bus. Success? Shutdown went well. What can we learn from this? Safety advances are good even if not mandated by OSHA or NSPE. It is possible to ground out low voltage panels without extraordinary efforts. Case 13, testing IT panels for overload and documentation. The situation. Corporate management and IT management agree that the existing power distribution system in the data center should be documented and available capacity recorded. And you can see what's going on. They wanted to buy some more servers. They weren't sure where they could get away with plugging them in. Neither corporate nor IT wanted an unplanned shutdown. I didn't mind having an unplanned shutdown. I'd like to watch them scurry and run around like that. I always think when they block my email that we should get even with them. Maybe I'm not a nice guy. Yeah, I think we can all agree I'm not a nice guy. How to trace equipment power cords to see where they are plugged in without touching them. How to trace power source circuits from plug strips back to the panel without a flasher or tone injection tracer. Now, I've got both those gadgets. I could plug it in and run a sensor down the front of the closed panel and determine which breaker it was, but they wouldn't let me plug it in. I wasn't allowed to plug into their plug strip in the back of the rack to see where it was fed by, because they were afraid I'd bump something and it would knock it off. Alternative, schedule a weekend or late night testing session so that an unplanned shutdown can be accommodated. Try to be very careful and do it during the day, perhaps after 5 p.m. Give up and go work on something else where you can make progress. Discussion of ethics. Please see case 2, selection of copper or aluminum conductors. There seems to be a recurring theme of conveying engineering knowledge to decision makers. Choice A was unacceptable to IT. Staying up late was unacceptable. I offered to do the testing with no chargeback or request for comp time off, but they would not do it. Choice B was unacceptable. IT was in the habit of coming in early to do software installs. They didn't want to work both early and late. I couldn't bear to get up at 4 a.m., but the opportunity was never offered. Choice C sounds like dereliction of duty and abrogation of engineering responsibilities to the firm. What did we do? The testing was never scheduled. Choice C prevailed. Success of the selection. Documentation of the power circuits and available capacity was never performed. 2 years later, the firm authorized a $50,000 expense to expand the computer room and install a new power panel and new circuits to the new racks. IT designed the connections of the equipment to the plug strips and circuits. What can we learn from this? Well, a previous case suggested that ignorance, lethargy, and inaction are powerful forces in technical decision making. In this case, ignorance, lethargy, and inaction won again. There's no governmental mandate to document data center power circuits. However, every voluntary guide published recommends such documentation. The recommendations do not address the possibility of unplanned shutdown resulting from power cable connection verification. Now, let me add a little more to this. I'm sorry for taking your time. I hope this is valuable. They didn't know what building power panel the computer room panel came from. I mean, that's how limited it was. If the computer panel went off, they didn't know where to go to reset the breaker, but they'd call the building electrician. Okay, let's do case 14, surge protection devices at building entrances. The National Electric Code requires surge protection devices for every electrical service where they enter a building. This is in section 708.20.D. Surge protection devices shall be provided at all facility distribution voltage levels. Section 285 discusses tiered application of surge protection devices at the power surface, at the distribution panel, and at the load panel. See also UL 1449 standard for surge protection devices. The questions: why are surge protection devices so rarely observed at building power services? Why are tiered surge protection devices almost never seen? When I say never, in my inspections, I have never seen them. I see them in computer rooms, Mostly I see them in computer rooms where I install them in computer rooms. I have never been able to convince owners to install them. I think I did them in a couple schools. I think I did get some surge protection devices at the main zone of a couple schools. Okay, alternatives include type 2 surge protection devices that service branch panels and significant loads in future designs. B, apply type 2 surge protection devices selectively on panels feeding critical equipment. C, sit down with the design manager and negotiate surge protection devices into the design basis. And D, ignore surge protection devices. Now, I noticed that I never explained what type 2 is. In the 2008 code, they distinguish surge protectors into type 1, type 2, and type 3. Type 1 is on the utility side of the main disconnect. Type 2 is on the customer side of the utility disconnect. Size 3, your type 3, is a flimsy thing that'll blow up if you put it on the main panel. So type 2 is the universal heavy-duty inside the building surge protector. The type 3 is fine for a computer panel, but anyway, now you know what type 2 means. Discussion of ethics. Choice A seems to meet the standards and implications of the National Electric Code. Put in a lot of surge protectors. The devices are clearly required in some instances and provide value to the owner in every case. Now that is, surge protectors perform cumulative. Best protection is when you have one at the service entrance, spikes that get past the first one are further attenuated by the second one, and even more by the third. Another consideration is that most disturbances are internally generated at the facility, and this is referenced to a place called engineeringtoolbox.com, electrical transients, and best addressed close to the source. Note that production copiers are well known as major internal transient sources, and this is from a place called Wisconsin Public Service. Who do you think they might be? /business/surge. Choice B appears to address NEC requirements in NSPE Code of Ethics while observing the business mantra of cost containment. Choice C has the advantage of offering an opportunity for development of favorable personal interactions, establish a reputation of technical expertise, and being a team player. If handled well, choice A may result. If unsuccessful, you can blame the project manager or instead of yourself. Make sure you document the meeting for later recrimination meetings. Choice D seems to satisfy the criterion of ignorance, lethargy, and inaction. Well, the activity selection. I have been pursuing choice B on recent project. I'm not sure if I'm proud of this decision or if I would recommend it to if consulted by another engineer. I am weak. I avoid confrontation. Choice of selection. Actually, I get compliments from end users. Now, this is really out of the ordinary. IT folks don't get much input into facility designs, and they are pleased when their needs are met. I always put SPDs in network closets. Remember, equal value would be achieved from SPDs on panels that serve large copiers and HVAC and factory equipment. What can we learn from this? Engineers are compelled to use economic current technology for the benefit of end users, that is the public and NSPE talk. The question remaining is, how strong are you in pursuing public benefits that add cost to the project? It's a graduated scale. Here's a digression. I did electrical design for a series of speculative warehouses for a builder. The goal was absolute least cost of construction, with the expectation the buyer or tenant would spend his money to add frills he wanted. The builder deleted the SPDs at the service panel and office panel. My justification for agreeing was that the buyer or tenant was being required to do electrical design before move-in, so the SPDs were only being transferred, not eliminated. Do you consider this a cop-out? Okay, let's move on. Case 15, applying short circuit withstand ratings. The situation, National Electric Code requires electrical equipment, distribution, and end-use equipment be applied within its ratings. That's in 2008 NEC Section 110.9, interrupting rating. In order to comply, the specifier must know the available short circuit current at the point of application. Available short circuit current requires calculations that are somewhat difficult and very tedious, or buying a $10,000 software program. Up until the current situation, I have never had available short circuit current values for any design job I have worked on. Well, the question then is how to comply with the NEC. Alternatives: learn to do computations or convince your boss to buy the $10,000 software. That sounds good. Get a demo version of the software and run 840 typical cases with different transformers and feeder lengths. Or make scientific wild-ass guesses. Choice A is a textbook answer. In the real world, few persons have motivation to spend discretionary time learning new skills. In the real world, few supervisors really want 10x billable hours invested in something as arcane as short circuit calculations. In the real world, few firms will spend $10,000 on software that they can't charge back to a client or project. Choice B resulted in a new PDH course called Simplified Calculation of Available Short Circuit Currents. The tables can be downloaded for free from pdhonline.org. Data cannot be copyrighted. Choice C means that you try hard to get the available short circuit current from the utility and do simple calculations of the form I short circuit equals KVA divided by V line to line divided by the square root of 3 to see what the short circuit current is at the transformer terminals. This is a real world value and is a valid guide for downstream connections. Downstream connections must have lower short circuit current. You have to guess, however, how much lower. The activity selected, as indicated, up to the current month, I have pursued choice C. Earlier this month, I submitted tables of 840 software results for more accurate scientific guesses. Success: all of the arc flash hazard literature starts out with catastrophic cases of misapplication of available short circuit current, that either you didn't know it and put in something inferior, or you did know it and chose to put in something inferior, and kabam, somebody got hurt. That's an unfavorable evaluation of choice C. What we can learn from this: I'm proud of my constructive response to the problem. I hope that design engineers will have the opportunity to demonstrate motivation to use the simplified method. I hope that design firms will invest in the modeling software and provide the best scientific guesses to design projects. Now we're going to go into the final case, and this is a little different from the others, and if you wish, you may discount it as off the beam and not engineering. But I couldn't help myself. My teeth would have blown out if I didn't include this. When you fake sincerity, you can achieve anything. In 1997, my son started asking difficult questions about truth and ethics. I enrolled him in an ethics course at the University of Chicago. We still talk about this roughly on a weekly basis. He's now a graduate student at Harvard, so that I listen more than I talk, but I still object to invalid observations and conclusions that don't track from the observations. My son has identified a universal truth as follows: when you learn to fake sincerity, you can achieve anything. Stop. That's from DJ Mason, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. The question: Barack Obama refuses to release his personal health report, his college grades, or any of the written work he did while in college or as editor of the Law Review during his college days. We elected him because we believe he has good intention and is sincere towards implementing government that furthers these good intentions. Lacking facts, we apparently chose sincerity. Alternatives: we could extensively explore all sources of information available on the internet and choose a president who has performed in a way that matches your goals and beliefs. Watch the television debates and select the candidate whose stated intentions and demeanor you find most impressive. Give up as impossible the gathering of valid information on the candidates and follow your gut reaction or the recommendation of someone you trust. Or finally, stay home and don't vote. Well, a discussion of these alternatives, choice A brings the immediate response that the media generally fell in love with Obama. There was very little factual information reported by the mainstream media, and personal blogs are suspect to accuracy and slant. Keep in mind that mainstream media is also suspect as to accuracy and slant. There were valid, critical facts and opinions available on the internet, but they were few. Choice B brings to fore how artificial the television debates were. It appeared that each candidate just waited his turn to read his prepared speech. They had good speechwriters and presented the material persuasively. Choice C gets a lot of support. If we agree that we are unable to get information to make a meaningful decision, at least we feel good with the decision we end up making. Choice D is rational, but reason is not rewarded in our society. Activity selected. Well, we chose Barack Obama over John McCain. That is a fact. Choice C is widely credited with being responsible for most of the votes cast on both sides. Success of the selection. The course is being written at the time between President Obama's selection and inauguration. The reader is better able to evaluate the success of the selection than is the writer. What can we learn from this? The example of the U.S. presidential election tends to support the initial hypothesis that when you learn to fake sincerity, you can achieve anything. I'm not sure I learned anything from this example. John Kennedy had serious medical problems that he hid from the public. You can find out about this in DrZebra.com, President number 35. Franklin Roosevelt had serious medical problems that he hid from the public. Again, Dr. Zebra, President number 32. Would disclosure have improved the quality of election decisions we made in 1932, 1944, and 1960? JFK and FDR were supremely successful in transmitting sincerity to the public. It's now known that FDR was working to change public opinion from anti-Brit to pro-Brit. He supported isolationism until public opinion swung sufficiently. Is that faking sincerity? JFK officiated over the Bay of Pigs fiasco and the Russian missiles in Cuba crisis. Was he fully candid with the public, or was he faking sincerity? Current history, and that's kind of a joke in its own right, reports that the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis was based upon our removing missiles from Turkey, not on television posturing. Digression. It continues to amaze me how history changes. In an audio course on Judaism, the professor stated that not even God can change history. Only historians can change history. This is a well-known reference to a story in the Torah about biblical scholars refusing God's intervention in their discussion. In the context of our current discussion of presidents and public perception and the changing course of history regarding specific events, I will be extremely interested in the rehabilitation of Richard Nixon, which I found discussed in a place called openlibrary.org/B/OL111761 4M. This completes the course. There was a comment here about seeing what happens as the Bush perspective on the Bush years develop, but that's more of this off-the-wall stuff. The course is complete. We have talked about electrical engineering and ethics. I've tried to present information I get from reading the NSPE. I hope we can read the same source and reach similar conclusions. I've indicated some cases where I tried to apply these, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. The quiz questions will be about the cases, not about the right way to do it, but about what was going on in the cases. I hope it's been valuable to you, and I hope you fill out the comment section after the quiz to tell us how we can improve the course. Thank you very much for joining me.